It's time to say goodnight to inefficient night storage heaters. Bulky, unattractive, with no precise control, leaving you boiling in the morning and rather chilly at night. So tune in to Fisher Future Heat, home heating systems that give you a steady, controllable supply of heat 24 hours a day. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric.
Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 720. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris. About to be joined by our senior editor, Jason Jones. It's that time of year again, the 2016 NFL Draft. Of course, we are just a couple short days away as we are releasing this show from the release of Pro Football Draftology 2016, which will, as tradition holds, have this show embedded right on the cover so you can go back and revisit it and check and see what we've said for posterity. So, again, I'm not afraid of that. I'm not afraid of being held to account, and nor is this man, our senior editor, Jason Jones. So, Jason, let people go back, pick apart our predictions, our analysis over the course of time. I'm sure it will hold up to the eyes of history, as always.
Of course. That's why we do it. Pursuit of the fun of the game.
Absolutely. It's always interesting to cover this thing year in and year out. There are many years where you don't have what we've had already, which is, of course, the number one pick being dangled and ultimately sold. The Tennessee Titans, who didn't need a quarterback famously after picking Marcus Mariota last year, dangling that pick out there and getting a big, big haul. What's very interesting, a lot of people are comparing it to the deal that the Rams were on the other side of when they took Robert Griffin III in 2012. Again, what's very interesting about that is that the team that paid the price, the Washington Redskins, were not getting a quarterback held to be on the caliber of Andrew Luck, who went with the number one pick that year. And the thought was, that's a lot to give up for a guy who's not Andrew Luck, because a guy like that only comes along once a couple of years. The Rams now have done that. They have paid such a price for a quarterback who's not Andrew Luck, regardless of whether the big two, it's Carson Wentz or Jared Goff, regardless of who that is. Meanwhile, the Browns, who are at number two, have signed Robert Griffin III, a very incestuous league that we have here with all these circumstances revisiting themselves in different ways 4 years later. But your thoughts on this, who the Rams might take, who they should take at number one, and how we got to this point?
Well, let me just jump in and say one quick thing here. I think the haul that the Redskins gave up, and now that the Rams have given up, I don't think you give that up if, John Elway, Dan Marino, Joe Montana are on the board. But, you know, that's the whole draft philosophy thing. But getting past that, I think the answer to the question is I think they should take Wentz. However, you know, this period of time being the most deceptive period in all of sports, it's tough to know what to trust, but everything that seems to be coming down seems to very softly be pointing to the idea that Goff being picked there wouldn't be such an egregious thing.
What's very interesting is that, again, there are echoes of past drafts, of course, coming up here with this pick. You saying it should be Wentz. I say, as a Browns fan, from your lips to God's ears, because I have been saying turn your head and cough for Goff for months now for the Browns. And they are on the verge of getting him at number two if that happens. But what's very interesting, I see some echoes here when you're talking about upside versus more of a sure thing kind of a deal. Some echoes of 2 years ago. I was very much a Bridgewater guy. You were very much a Manziel guy. Now, with Wentz, it's a different set of issues here. It's not the immaturity. He has all the physical tools that, again, and I was somebody on record decrying Manziel for the physical tools as well as the immaturity. But with Carson Wentz, it's merely the whole process of elimination thing, the competition that he played against, I should say, and not being very, very strong versus Goff has faced the Pac-12 the last couple of years. But what's interesting, we got to an off-season where seemingly in comparison to Manziel and some of the other quarterbacks, Bridgewater was really kind of getting negged a lot by a lot of the critics out there, which really looks kind of dumb right now because he's gone out and done everything that I thought he would do. But you look at Goff, you know, we're hearing this stuff like, well, yeah, he can make the big throws. He can fit it in the tight windows. But, and I've seen enough of these idiots like Brandon Wheaton in Cleveland over the course of the last couple of years to say, why are we saying, yeah, but when it comes to a guy who can make the throws and fit it into the windows? So I find the whole thing really kind of interesting as far as the breakdown between Wentz and Goff. Yeah, Goff is more of a sure thing, a little lower of a ceiling, but me personally, I'm fine with that. Break it down as you see it.
Well, yeah, I think the big detail here to keep our attention on is this notion that Goff is pro-ready, but mm-hmm. his ceiling may not be too high, but so what? I mean, if he's pro-ready and he's efficient and he looks the way he did in Cal, there's absolutely no reason to discount him, just like there was no reason to discount Bridgewater. With that being said, there's the NFL loves upside, and I think sometimes they yep. get a little carried away. I don't know about you, but if I were to sort of average together everything I've heard about Wentz over the last few months, I would think that the world is projecting this guy to be some combination of Roethlisberger meets Joe Flacco. And while that may not be putting him up against Tom Brady or Joe Montana, it is a little steep. It's a little much to take just on spec. So I do love his physical ability. I think he's very solid. I've actually come around more to him lately. But that being said, I don't think you make that pick based on what you think Wentz will be despite what you know Goff will be. So I think either way, he's the way to go. And Goff was the guy I was hoping would go number two to the Browns before the RG3 thing. I kind of have a problem with them picking quarterback at this point. But putting that aside, I think, it to me right now, they almost feel like six of one, half dozen of another. Do you want to hope for huge upside and this guy is going to be a top five quarterback in 5 years? Or do you just take a guy you know can run an offense and be efficient and fit the ball into tight windows? And he's got an arm. It's not like he's a manager. He's a very solid prospect. So I think you can't lose either way. And if you want Goff, by all means, if they take Wentz, it's Christmas morning for you.
Absolutely. I would say that's certainly the case. And as I look at it, there's a compelling case to be made either way if you're Los Angeles image-wise. You've got the return of football out there after 20 years. The NFL finally stopped dropping the ball and getting a team put back out there. But by the way, I don't know that I've ever felt so old as when I saw, and as someone who I believe is a millennial, on Twitter the night of the move, like, Los Angeles Rams, that doesn't even sound right. And I'm just going, oh, I'm way too old for this world. I'm living in a world where people can't
sound right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still getting St. Louis Rams not to sound clunky in my mind, and they've already left from there, you know. So I've been on this earth way too long if it's populated with a lot of people that have never heard of the Los Angeles Rams. But the Rams are back in L.A. They're looking to get their quarterback, their face of the future. It just happens to coincide with this need that they have a quarterback with this moment of moving there. And, again, you could look at it like, okay, well, Goff's the SoCal guy. He's the guy that you can build around from there. But to me, Wentz almost more fits the prototype for number one overall, doesn't he? Because of what you said about upside. I'm talking purely image here. I'm on record as saying I would take Goff between the two of them. But image is very, very important. L.A. is getting reestablished there with a football team. And image-wise, Wentz just looks like the guy to me, right? That, like, if he can develop those physical skills, which a lot of people are comparing to Andrew Luck, and as you said, Roethlisberger, so versus Goff, there's a lot of people that might portray that as settling for him at number one. So I'm just guessing that from a marketing point of view.
Yeah, I mean, there's the California connection on the Goff side, and of course, you know, Wentz absolutely looks the part. So, again, I think you can't lose either way.
Yeah, I think so if you're the Rams. And, again, there are a lot of very powerful NFL reporters out there on both sides of this issue claiming that they know who it's going to be, and there are a lot of dissenting opinions. I don't really remember a situation like this where there have been this many big names staking their reputation as far as it being this guy and half of them saying this guy. So we'll have to see how that shakes out. What the offseason has wrought is that when we started it, it looked like the big two at quarterback was going to be Paxton Lynch along with Goff. And subsequently, as Wentz has gone up, it's not necessarily a zero-sum game because it doesn't have to be, right? We could have three marquee quarterbacks, supposedly, but we don't at this point because the perception of Paxton Lynch has gone down, that rocket arm that he has. Again, the level of competition seems to be held against him a little bit, even though he played against better competition than did Wentz in college. But he's a guy who kind of scared me because of the aforementioned Brandon Weeden. I'm not making a direct comparison there, but when anybody tells me million-dollar arm, that's not nearly enough for me to say, oh, go get him. And I'm afraid a lot of teams have come to the same kind of conclusion about him at this point.
Yeah, need I insert the Jamarcus Russell analogy on the arm?
Right.
Just because you can throw it a mile doesn't mean you can play quarterback.
Right. And that's basically how it has all kind of shaken out as far as teams looking at him and figuring that he has a ways to go to sort of develop the rest of his game. And Derek Anderson, somebody that you and I saw up close in Cleveland many years ago, they used to say about him that, you know, he can make every throw except the short and intermediate ones. And I was like, that's perfect, right? Because, like, those are ones I can make in a backyard game. Derek Anderson is a highly paid NFL quarterback. Surely he's going to learn to make those. Derek Anderson could never learn to make that 15-yard pass to save his life. So that's kind of an extreme example, I guess, of what we're talking about.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not far-fetched at all because, you know, you look at some of these prospects and guys, especially if you go back to that Jamarcus Russell issue, these GMs, owners, whoever, find one or two characteristics that they really love, and a lot of times it's a strong arm, whether it's accurate or not, or the, you know, no one ever takes the time to think about can they read defenses, can they lead the receiver, can they put the ball in a position that's not going to get their receiver killed, and, you know, on some level, you know, that's come up with Goff a little bit. He can fit in tight windows, but sometimes he kind of leaves his receivers out to dry, but all in all, you can't just pick one thing and fall in love with it. You got to look at the total picture because, as you know, broadcasting from Cleveland, you and I and other people in the area definitely are familiar with quarterbacks who had something we liked and just couldn't put it together. So I don't really love it when you hear these people repeatedly proclaim the same thing over and over again and disregard the others. So, you know, you got to do your due diligence and see what works best for you. I know there are teams out there that say that golf fits them better regardless of upside, and there are teams out there that say, I like the big-bodied, strong-arm quarterback, and we'll figure the rest out later, and that can be dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. You better know what you're doing, and you better have some good quarterback gurus in place if you're going to go that route. We're going to get to some of the strong areas of the draft, which that's the less sexy kind of thing to talk about here. But since we're on skill positions, let's just kind of blow through that. I've been saying for a couple of years now that I have seen maybe a little bit of a turning of the tide coming in this league as far as the bell cow running back coming back. I thought that Todd Gurley was going to sort of be on the leading edge of that. You saw it last year coming off of the ACL surgery. He still had one of the best years of anybody in the league. So look out in year two. You've got Ezekiel Elliott coming in to the league this year. You've got Leonard Fournette, presumably the year after, and he's somebody who definitely fits this bill as well. Derrick Henry, when he was worked out in the offseason here, was very interesting to me. I don't know if you saw this, but when they were running through, these computers now can kind of match up profiles of players statistically in a way that was unheard of even a couple of years ago. They said that physically, the last player that he was really reminiscent of that came out was Von Miller, of all things. So I thought that was kind of interesting as far as an outside linebacker versus a running back. But these are the two dominant guys that you've got running back-wise in the draft. Ezekiel Elliott, by far number one of the two, could go in the top 10. Derrick Henry, a little more iffy where he's going to land because, again, the suspicion of running backs in recent years and how much you want to pay for him. But Elliott looks to me like a guy, just off the top of my head, if he went in Dallas, boy, he could be a threat to break 2,000 yards year one.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to a coworker of mine and making the joke that there are certain teams out there that I don't like my guys going to.
And by all means, Dallas is not one of them. I'm not a Dallas hater. So that offensive line and the way they've built that roster lately does set up beautifully for a guy like Ezekiel Elliott. The one that I am referring to, though, is the notion that he'll go to Philly, which is something I absolutely do not want to happen. But that aside, it's no secret that I loved Gurley, and to me it was not even close when comparing him to Melvin Gordon. And maybe that's just because I have a thing with Wisconsin running backs. They're kind of like Alabama running backs. They come in with way too many miles on the tires. But to be honest with you, the upside of Ezekiel Elliott and what we know he can do, the things I think he can do that he wasn't asked to do at Ohio State, to be honest with you, knowing that the Rams are going quarterback, I would not be upset one way or the other if he went as high as two. And I'm not – that's not a cryptic thing. I mean, yeah, I'd love him to go to the Browns. But two, three, four, five, six, I don't really care. I think he's that good. He's a different kind of runner than Gurley, but I think of the same caliber. And I think whoever takes him is absolutely going to be more than content with that selection.
Yep. They're both big, powerful guys, and they've got that extra gear. That's really sort of, the equivalent of when you talk about fantasy baseball, the five-tool player who can do it all. If you're a big guy in the NFL, big running back who can also run like a scat back, that's pretty much the total package. And Elliott has it. It'll be interesting to see where he lands. Wide receiver, not surprising given that, again, 2014, kind of a historic class. I've been comparing it for a long time to the class of 96, and it looks like it's going to shape up that way. 2015, interestingly enough, kind of getting an incomplete. You've got a lot of guys, especially from a fantasy perspective, that we can consider rookies coming into this year because they didn't get a chance to do a whole lot, if anything, last year. Guys like Perriman in Baltimore and Kevin White in Chicago. So this year's rookie class is really sort of, in a weird way, inclusive of last year as well, which does make it a little bit deeper in the NFL sense as far as impact guys in year one. The dominant player at the position, as many have been saying, Laquon Treadwell from Ole Miss. You've got Corey Coleman, a little bit of a different kind of a player coming out of Baylor as well. You start to go down a little bit further from there, Michael Thomas at Ohio State. So thoughts on wide receivers, which, again, with the NFL passing game of the last 15 years or so, the vertical game has been very, very important. So thoughts on how somebody like Treadwell, who was thought at one point to be a very, very strong contender to go in the top three or so, on how it's all going to shake out.
Well, I do like the wide receiver crop here. However, let's not get it confused. This is not 2014. 2014, you had a handful of guys that both in physical measurables and talent and ability looked like they project to prototypical number ones. 6'2" to 6'4", 220-plus, run sub-4.5s. That's great. That's not what this is. I think Laquon Treadwell is a great example. When you start looking at how they project out, and this is just conceptual, to be honest, I feel like he's a little Antonio Brown with the upper body and arm strength post-catch of a guy like a Terrell Owens or a Steve Smith. When you watch him, he really does find wonderful ways to catch the ball with his hands. He has no problem going up and getting at the peak of the trajectory. And once he catches it, he's definitely hard to take down. And I can't remember the last time I saw somebody easily strip the ball from him after the catch. So there's a lot of things to love about him. Coleman, I really like as well. I think he's absolutely a first-round talent, but he's not even 6 foot. So you're starting to get into this area where, yeah, you're getting productive guys that can really be difference makers, but they're not A.J. Green, Calvin Johnson type guys. They're not going to burn you over the top and out jump the defensive backs all the time. So there's something to be had there, and I think that's a little bit of why we're not seeing Treadwell, Coleman, or even Fuller being touted as going anywhere near the top 10. I think if you need a wide receiver, you can get a heck of a player in the 20s, all the way through the first round. And there's even a good chance that teams at the top, the Titans, the Browns, and so on,
those types of teams that might be in need, and Titans may not really need them so much as they need to get guys healthy. But I think you can really get a solid, solid player in the top half of the second round, especially if guys are going to reach on someone like Fuller. Not that I don't like him. I just think everyone's really in love with his speed, kind of like the quarterback thing. Going back to Al Davis, you can't fall in love with speed exclusively. So I think the crop is good. I think it probably goes 15 deep as far as eventual potential starters, but I don't think that this is 2014.
No, it's clearly not. And again, yeah, like you said, there could be some bargain shopping available at the top of the second round and perhaps even a shade deeper, depending on how it all kind of shakes out from there. But before we get to what is the best area of the draft, I would say on both sides of the ball in the trenches here, just to talk about something that could impact the top five as well, and that being a couple of the top defensive backs in the draft here. Jalen Ramsey, who a lot of people are saying may be the most physically gifted player in the entire draft, Vernon Hargraves as well. These are both guys who are super athletes, who have great college production, who, again, just look amazing on film and project so well to the next level here. So thoughts on what either one of these guys can bring, because they both look like franchise players in the defensive secondary.
Well, as far as this line of thought goes, I am absolutely 100% on one side of this argument, and that is if you're picking Jalen Ramsey to play free safety, then – put all your money there and run with it, because he's talented, he's gifted, he's athletic. He is opportunistic, so it's not so much that he gets or creates interceptions and turnovers. It's that he's in the right spot at the right time, and sometimes that tends to concern me a little bit. I'd much rather get a guy that you just know technique, ball-hawking ability. He's the difference maker. I think Ramsey will be a difference maker. I just think he gets there a different way. Now, if Ramsey you're picking to be your number one shutdown corner, then you're going to have a bad time with it. I think he's a good corner, but I think he projects to being a great safety. Now, Hargraves, I love. If you're a team that's in need of a corner, whether you need a guy to pair up with your established Pro Bowler, let's say just hypothetically if Arizona was picking in the top five, and they decide to go that route, you put Patrick Peterson with Hargraves and Matthew, then you've got one hell of a secondary. I think he's far and away the best corner. I think he might be the best corner the last couple years. So he would be the guy I'd go with. But what's really interesting is after Ramsey, if you're picking him at safety, there's really no other safety to get excited about until Keanu Neal, who's probably going to go in the second round anyway. And then corner, I think Hargraves is the sweepstakes. And then after that, two through six are actually really, really solid corners who are all have the potential to be starters. Whether they're shut down or not, that's a whole different discussion. But corner's an interesting one. I just think Hargraves is the prize.
In terms of those two guys, and when you were talking about them at their best, I think I already know what your answer is going to be on this, but the way I'd like to phrase this question, I go back a couple of years ago to when Green Bay took Ha-Ha Clinton Dix in the draft. And that's a team that, again, offensively, I mean, aside from the struggles that they had last year, which we know why that was, because the wide receiver core was in a shambles due to injury. But generally, it's been the defense that's kind of held them back. And I looked at that as a pick where they were looking at him to be, in the military lingo, sort of a force multiplier, somebody who you put him in there and it can have a great ripple effect. And the ironic thing is that the best example of him doing that was in a losing effort in the NFC Championship game against Seattle. He had a couple of interceptions. He was really kind of disrupting things. And I got the sense watching the game that his presence was really lifting up everyone around him. So are these two guys, if used in their best roles, similar in terms of being able to be force multipliers, where basically they can help raise the games of everyone around them, whether it be by attracting attention or by getting them in more of a position to make plays in addition to what they're doing?
Well, sure, absolutely, for Ramsey. I mean, that's a no-doubter. Ramsey's the kind of guy you put in your locker room, you put in those defensive meetings, you get him out on the field, and he just finds a way to sort of raise the caliber of everyone in that defensive unit. Being the back-end hawk that he is, it's going to open up opportunities for other guys. Eventually, if he's everything we think he's going to be, and, you know, you run him on one side of the field, quarterback's going to be less likely to throw over there. So that's absolutely going to change things. With Hargraves, I don't know if that's so much a thing with him. I think he does improve the situation. I just don't think he's as dynamic in that way as a Ramsey would be, which is why I think people love Ramsey so much. I do also think, though, that Hargraves is the kind of guy you put on your number one receiver and just put him on the island if you have to. So a little bit of yes on both, but definitely more so on Ramsey.
Well, and that must be why, again, just about everybody has him a little bit higher on the board, including us with the FDH boards. That's a very good answer. I like the way you got into that and sort of broke that down. After talking about all these wonderful athletes, all these different positions here, time to at least figuratively eat our vegetables here by talking about the less sexy positions here, the trenches, because, again, that's where the strength of this draft in top-level talent and in depth really lies. Let's first talk about the guy who is, I would say, the poster child for all of this. A couple of very highly players coming out of Ole Miss in this year's draft. None of them more so than Laramie Tunsil, an offensive tackle, who, again, that was the pick that everybody had penciled in for Tennessee if they were keeping it, because he is your prototypical, at least in everyone's mind, left tackle, put him out there for 15 years, racks up a dozen Pro Bowls, keeps your quarterback healthy, et cetera. How do you rate Tunsil versus the best offensive tackles of recent years to come out?
I think he's right up there, to be honest with you. I mean, if you really look at it, I don't know that we've had anyone come out since Joe Thomas that you look at and go, okay, there's your left tackle, your blind side for the next 10 to 15 years, and he'll go to a Pro Bowl every year. I don't know that we've had a whole lot of those. So with that being said, I think at worst in the last 5 years, Tunsil's probably one or two. And, you know, this has got to make people like Jacksonville sick to their stomach with picking Joku the way where they did, because this guy is remarkably better. And to be honest with you, if I was a Tennessee Titans fan who's interested in building from the trenches out, I'm glad they got the picks they got, but I'm a little disappointed that you're not going to be able to get Tunsil, because I really don't see that he lasts past three at San Diego.
Well, whether it be in fantasy sports or in real sports, a lot of times you start to get into that whole cliche of four quarters doesn't equal a dollar, and that is a thing that may very well apply in this situation here, because unless Tennessee can collectively get the value of a Tunsil, who, if he stays healthy and keeps his head on straight, projects as a Hall of Fame player, unless they can collectively get that out of a nice bundle that they got, then they didn't win that deal, even though the Rams gave up, as you and I both said, an insane amount to be able to do this. But what's interesting is, and I wonder if you put any stock in this, there's a little bit of talk, supposedly, of the Titans, who are now armed with a lot of draft picks, as you may have heard, them possibly looking to move back up, get a few spots down from where they were, and maybe try to be in position to pick up somebody. One would think Tunsil that they would be looking at, because the Browns at two, unless they trade out of it, probably don't project to be doing that. As you said, there's always San Diego at three. So one wonders if Tennessee might be mulling some kind of a backup plan, maybe to still try and get him.
Well, and that would be really impressive, because then you move Tyler Lewan over to the right side, keep Tunsil on the left, and with your new quarterback and new setup, he pretty much set there for the future. So if they do that, if we're sitting here on draft day and we see that they've given up and all these picks, and then they're getting all these picks to move down, and then we see them wheeling and dealing to move some of those picks to get back up to a point where maybe they can get Laramie Tunsil, then, without rolling in my own hyperbole, that might be one of the more brilliant moves I've seen of any top pick team in recent memory, because, yeah, the picks are nice, but let's be honest, the Rams, even as far back as St. Louis, they've found ways to beat good teams. I don't know that they need to spend those six picks on six players, and if they end up packing some of that to move back up, it could be one of the more brilliant moves of recent memory.
Yeah, it really, really would. I think we would probably be putting this right up alongside the Herschel Walker trade and so many other great ones in NFL history, if somehow or another Tennessee can manage to have their cake and eat it too. I think that's why you and I are kind of as leery of the prospect of it happening as that, because it would be so hard. It would be a once-in-a-generation kind of a thing for them to be able to do that and still have a few picks left over at the end of it. Before we move to the defensive side of the ball, again, in talking about the trenches on the offensive side, there are still some other very good prospects. Nobody else who is a certain top five pick. Ronnie Stanley could well go in the top 10 potentially. Jack Conklin is somebody who looks like he could possibly make it into the top 20 as we're taping this here. There's a couple of other pretty good prospects here as you start to get to the end of round one, into the second round, Taylor Decker, Jason Spriggs, et cetera. So as you look at it, who are some of the other guys that you think could really make some noise and be a foundation-type player, which is what the NFL is looking for, of course, in the first round?
Well, let's not, you know, undersell it. The basic idea here seems to be that Tunsil's the number one guy, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody in their right mind who's looking at offensive tackle who would pick somebody else if Tunsil's on the board. Now, that aside,
right,
it's almost like Tunsil's on tier one by himself, and then Stanley's only a tier all by himself, and then you've got this nice collection of Jack Conklin, Taylor Decker, Jason Spriggs, Jermaine Effetti, and if you need a little position Vidal Alexander, if I'm saying that right, from LSU, is the guy who could probably swing right tackle or either guard spot. So those guys are probably the big names we're going to see through pick, say, 50 to 60. And then, as we go a little farther down, LaRaven Clark from Texas Tech is nice. And then you start to get into some more of this position eligibility stuff with some of these guys that project to being a near typical right tackle but better at guard. And it really depends on what we find the needs to be, say, after we get into the second round. But of that group, I think Taylor Decker is probably an incredibly good right tackle. I think Jack Conklin can play either one, but I think the guy to keep your eye on, especially if you're in a position of need and you're picking towards the end of the first round, is Jason Spriggs at Indiana. There's just something about him. Footwork's good. His hands are good. Agility's good. He's just good. He's just solid. Now, is he going to be, you know, Joe Thomas or one of these other guys that comes out and you just know you don't have to worry about? Probably not. But, you know, you can probably step in and start year one on either side, and then where you go from there depends on, you know, how the coaching goes and how the play goes. But I think Jason Spriggs is the X factor to see where the rest of the tackles go.
That's right. And, again, guys at the uber high level really don't grow on trees. And, again, so it's not really fair to hold anybody to that that level, that standard, and when you're evaluating them lower in the first round. So as you astutely point out, these guys have a very good chance, a couple of them, to outperform where they are being selected. We get to the defensive side of the ball, and again, this is where the true strength of the draft in terms of star power, depth, et cetera, really kind of shines. Defensive end, Joey Bosa has been pretty much towards the top for a while. An interesting thing with him, some people saying, well, I think he's more Jared Allen than he is J.J. Watt, as though Congress passed a law that said we can only compare him to white guys, which is kind of interesting. So, I mean, I'd take him if he was comfortably in that range anyways if I was a team. But DeForest Buckner, very, very explosive also there at defensive end. And you start to get down a little bit. Noah Spence, he's had some issues, but he's kind of a tweener maybe between defensive end, outside linebacker, but that might mean that he's more suited for a variety of systems. So you've got your pass rushers. You've got your hogs on the inside here with Sean Robinson, guys like that, guys like Sheldon Rankins, and on down through where it looks like you could probably get good defensive tackles to really help bolster your defense, potentially even into the third round here. So on the defensive side of the ball, with the hogs in the middle, with the pass rushing studs on the outside, it really looks like quite a bounty in 2016.
Oh, it does. And here's a funny thing. A lot of times when we talk draft, there's this notion that guys are going to fall or rise of no doing of their own. It's not that they've done something wrong to make them fall, or they didn't necessarily do anything great to have them rise. it's just that the needs of the team, the positioning, the way things shake out, you could end up having some movement. And in this draft, if this is one of those drafts where we said, I don't like quarterback, I don't like running back, I don't like receiver, and I don't like secondary, you could have 15 guys go in the first round from the defensive line. Now, is that going to happen? No way on earth is that going to happen. But that's just the kind of solid depth we've got here. And the funny thing is, all that being said, I'm not as high as some people are on Joey Bosa. And to be honest with you, that happened in the last couple months. So I'm a little leery to put it out there one way or the other. But coming into the offseason, I felt like he was a sure lock to go in the top five. Could go as high as two or three. My concern now is it's starting to creep in is a little bit of the Tre'Davion Clowney issue, where you look at him and you go, 2 years ago, he was unreal. And last year, it just seemed like maybe not as much. Not saying he was saving himself or he's taking plays off. It just looked like maybe not as great as he had been before. That being said, you'd be foolish not to think that he's a top five pick. And that is regardless of how things shake out. After him, though, you've got Buckner, who could play. He could play defensive tackle in a 4-3 and still be effective, but you really do want that guy rushing the quarterback. Noah Spence, I absolutely love from his work on the Senior Bowl. I absolutely think if you want an outside linebacker or a defensive end, it works either way. Some other big names there, Shaq Lawson, Emmanuel Ogba, Kevin Dodd, who I'm not as excited as I am for Spence, just because Spence seems to be a gritty, you know, throwback football player who's more interested in wrapping up and getting lost yards than he is for making highlights. And then, you know, we start getting into, you got the two guys from Alabama, Robinson and Reed, both step in and play defensive tackle right away. And I got to say, as much as it flies in the face of where the NFL is trying to be, my absolute favorite player on the defensive line in this entire draft is also the kind of player that most fans of teams don't want, and that's Robert Tamici. Ole Miss, one of the big three from Ole Miss, he's, you know, 6'3", 200 or 300 pounds, can play 4-3 defensive tackle, can play 3-4 out defensive end, could even, in a pinch, probably rush from a standing up position. But when you watch him, even as a defensive tackle, he just gets in there. He finds ways. He's kind of, he gives you that vibe that like a B.J. Raji, a Haloti Ngata, but athletic. You look at him and go, how on earth does a 300-pound man keep getting penetration to the quarterback? And I just love him as a player. Now, as a fan, I'd be shaking my boots a little bit, not going to lie, because there's some arrogance there. There's some off-the-field stuff. And I guess the difference I'm getting at here is if you're going to take a guy with a little bit of a checkered past, I'm more inclined to lean towards Spence in that regard as a pass rusher in general than I am to me, but that's only because it appears more that Noah Spence has been a little bit humbled and seems to be focused 100% on football and not so much on touting his own greatness. So, with the defensive line and the offensive tackles, it absolutely is the cream of this draft.
It really, really is. And that's the thing, too. When you're looking at guys like Nemechi and Spence, it's all predicated, I would think, particularly with the microscope of today's NFL, with some of the very bad off-field situations we've had in recent years, about these guys getting to the right situation. And again, while they could thrive in a very good defense if it happened, you probably can already see where I'm going with this. It feels like either one of them could be Bengals, doesn't it? And that would be a dumpster fire. I mean, the Bengals love to do this. They love to collect guys like this, whose character on a good day is very questionable. And then things generally tend to go very well on field. Say that for them. They get the most out of these guys between the lines. Once you're not between the lines anymore, things kind of go south a little bit more. So these guys in particular would seem like you want to have them in the right situation, veteran guys who can mentor them, keep their heads on straight, et cetera.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because not that long ago I was watching the original I'm drawing a blank. The movie with the quarterback goes to prison.
Oh, yeah.
The longest yard?
Oh, jeez. Yeah, the longest yard, the original. And I remember thinking, are the Bengals the prison yard team that rolls up in the bus that has all these Hall of Fame greats walk off but are absolute degenerate people? Because you look at them and you're right, you're absolutely right. They not only stockpile these guys and have no fear of taking them at all, but they somehow get them to play, you know, until you're in a very must-need playoff win to potentially go to a Super Bowl, and then they all implode. But,
right.
Yeah, I think it's a very astute analogy you just made there.
Well, thank you. And in looking at it, it's funny because the ways that they get these guys, it's not always even the high draft picks or whatever. If memory serves, they didn't even have to spend one on a guy like Vontaze Burfict, who we knew coming into that draft was one of the most talented players of that entire crop. But the other teams stayed away from him because they treated him as though he was coated in dog poop. And, again, between the lines, it generally hasn't been an issue, except for when he's taking cheap shots or going too far or whatever the case may be. But aside from that, his production has been vital to their development as a great defense. But they've been doing this for a long, long, long time now with Marvin Lewis.
Yeah, no, they have. And, I think I'm not alone in being surprised that he's able to hold on to that job. And I believe they just extended him recently. So there's there's some stuff there. But when you look at it as a fan, just sort of watching the draft unfold over the years, the Bengals more than any other team have, for lack of a better term, snaked me on what I would hope for my own team. It's with Burfict, it was a perfect example. Maluga was another one. And, of course, they took the Russian dude that I love so much a couple years ago. But when they pick Burfict, you get to like the fifth round, and any fan of any team looking to improve a position has got to be furious when you see a player like that just keep falling. And Cincinnati paid nothing for him. And they got him, and he's been one of the more productive, defensive players, regardless of his background. But for some reason, they keep making those picks, and until it really bites them, I don't think that they're going to stop anytime soon.
They do indeed keep making those. By the way, that didn't defy me there. Very well played on your part, the little David Caruso thing there where you were like, well, Jay, I guess you could say Vontaze was the perfect example of that. So, well played on your part, Jason. Just flipping that in there. Didn't know if I would catch it or not, but I did. So, yes, that was a very fine analysis of the Cincinnati defense and all of their issues over – and offensively, too. It's not as though offensively they haven't had some free spirits, if you will, over a period of time. But the ones that we first think of are defensive guys, and these are defensive guys we were talking about here. So I guess that's why we drew that connection. But the Bengals don't discriminate on either side of the ball when it comes to taking questionable citizens, shall we say. So any of these guys could possibly – end up down in the old Queen City. But it is a pleasure, as always, breaking this down with you, my man. I look forward to our traditional draft panel afterwards, get Chris Galloway on with us, along with you and I, another one of our fellow original FDH Lounge dignitaries. I always enjoy breaking that down with him afterwards, as I do with you ahead of time. So great job, my friend. Thank you very much. Your draft coverage in our draft guide, Pro Football Draftology 2016, of course, unparalleled as always with your player rankings, your top 75 overall. A real treat for the people. We will have that out in the next couple of days. But thank you so much, as always, for your great work, my man.
No problem. Happy to do it.
All right, my friend, and we will be staying in touch during this process and, as I say, reconvening after the draft for our usual analysis to break it all down. But as promised, we had for you one gem of a 2016 NFL draft preview. Myself, Rick Morris, and Jason Jones today. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge mini episode number 720.
For years and years, heating has meant boilers, and boilers have meant breakdowns. Over here, and over here. Anything but music to your ears. At Fisher Future Heat, we create state-of-the-art home heating systems that we fit, then you forget. With no annual servicing needed, and a huge 10-year guarantee. In short, we engineer common sense. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric.